Hear that? That's now Crispy and McCrispy strips meeting creamy Caesar sauce. Sounds extra crispy. Caesar sauce at McDonald's for a limited time. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
What's so great about Seventh Heaven?
Why do cowboys wear 10-gallon hats?
And how much was the million-dollar question originally worth?
We're putting two and two together as we turn it up to 11 and give more than two hoots about the origins of number-centric idioms on this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today you can count on a good time because we are addressing number-related idioms.
Jess, I've got your number.
Look at that.
Yeah, why are we doing this subject, Jess?
Somebody in our community asked us to do this. It was a really good idea, and there are loads of these, countless, you might even say.
Indeed. I mean, we do listen. You see, countless, that's a word first used by Shakespeare. There's one for you. Yeah, but that's not what we're talking about. So we're talking about number idioms. So idioms that have numbers in them, but I took the brief a little too literally, and I have also brought idioms with the word number in them. Maybe we should get those out of the way first.
Yes, we should. We should do those first. That sounds great. Let's jump right in with the numbers.
Podcasting by numbers.
Podcasting by numbers. Yes.
Actually, I looked that up because obviously I think it's obvious, but that relates to painting by numbers, which is where you have a pre-drawn painting with numbers equating to the numbers written on little pots of paint. And then you paint the right color on the right number and you end up with a beautiful picture. It makes you look like a terribly good painter. My nan did one once. She did it back in the, I don't know, the 60s or whatever. It was on her wall. I thought she was some sort of artistic genius. Didn't realize she'd done the painting by numbers. So far as the origins concerned, this is an American invention from the 1940s and 50s. Very, very popular. Millions and millions of painting by numbers kits sold in, I suppose, the wake of the Second World War, which is where people didn't have TikTok, I guess. This is what people were doing, but invented by a guy called Max S. Klein, who was an engineer from Michigan, and an artist called Dan Robbins.
Good on you, fellas.
Here's one that is listed in the dictionary as an American idiom, although I've definitely heard it plenty in the UK. To do a number on someone?
Yeah. Why do we say that?
What it is to sort of stitch someone up, right? It's to...
Oh, okay.
Win, isn't it? It's to do a number over someone, to fool them, to trick them, to do a number on someone.
Does it have to do with stitches?
Stitches, go on.
You said to stitch someone up. You meant that idiomatically speaking.
I did, yeah. Is that like the British equivalent, is it? Do you not call it, it's a stitch up?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard it again, but it's not something that I would say.
We don't know exactly where to do a number on someone comes from, but one of the theories is it's a vaudevillian term. You know, a number is a song.
Oh, yeah, a number is a song. Mm-hmm.
So it's to pull a performance on someone.
My guess out of nowhere was, with absolutely no backing whatsoever, was that it had to do with like boxing, like down for the count kind of things.
It's a good shout. It could be that. It could be that.
Rounds at least, in a fight.
I was just a little worried it was going to point me in the direction of a specific number, doing a specific number on someone, like doing a number two on someone, which would be a kind of similar thing.
But that has to be a later idiom,
yeah,
number two.
Of course it does. Of course it does. But I would ask people to, by all means, put their own theories in the comments below. Where does do a number on someone come from? To have someone's number, we obviously understand it. It's to know someone so well that you know their phone number.
Yes.
So to have worked someone out to that extent. Do you know who the first public enemy number one was?
No, but I feel like I should be able to guess. I'm not going to try because I'll embarrass myself.
I think you would be able to guess. Very, very famous American gangster.
Is it Biggie?
It's not.
Oh, is it Al Capone?
Ah, okay. So arguably it's Al Capone, because he was dubbed that by a newspaper, but it was the FBI who would designate this sort of official public enemy number one.
Okay.
And it was slightly later than Al Capone. It was John Dillinger.
Ah, very nice.
I think you would have got there. Because yeah, they're really, yeah. There are like two gangsters that British people know as well, but they're Al Capone and John Dillinger as well.
I got stuck on hip hop lyrics because I have a few related ones that
Public
pertain
Enemy.
To hip hop later, thinking too far ahead.
1934 is when John Dillinger is designated by J. Edgar Hoover himself as Public Enemy number one. Now it's like the most wanted, top 10 most wanted or whatever they call it by the FBI. But that was the sort of the birth of it. And John Dillinger was the first to get it. He was killed later that year outside of a movie theater. And I was reading about the circumstances of it. It's really interesting. The FBI set themselves up all around, like the local police. This was in Chicago. The local police were there, but they were told to just go away by the feds. And then as Dillinger was leaving the movie theater, the signal that he was on his way out was a man standing outside, and he just lit his cigar. Just the lighting of the cigar was the signal. Here comes Dillinger. And that's how they finally caught him. And three separate officers shot him. And he was dead pretty fast.
That makes sense. That does pertain to an idiom, or that reminds me of the idiom three on a match, which I wanted to bring up later, but I think it's more pertinent now. The notion is that the third person to light a cigarette from the same match will have bad luck, and the explanations, whether true or not, go back to various wars like the Crimean War or the First World War, which makes more sense for the idiom's timing. And according to that explanation, the first cigarette flame alerts a sniper, the second gives the sniper time to aim, and the third gives the sniper time to fire.
Oh, that's excellent. Oh, I like that so much. Isn't it great how we're just coming up with number idioms? They just pop up. This is why this was such a good suggestion. It's just that we're using them all the time and not necessarily knowing it. And so Dillinger's number was up, which is numbery idiom. Again, we don't know exactly what this referred to. Probably something like a lottery ticket or you call it the draft, right? A conscription ticket, you know, getting your conscription papers, getting your draft papers, you know, your number is up. It's your time to join the army, which is not necessarily a great thing at times of conscription. During the draft tends to be when it's not a great time to be in the army. It's when you're getting shot at the most, isn't it? But I found something quite interesting in the Oxford Dictionary of Idioms. It had a slightly different theory to other places. I'll just read it. I've written it down. I won't read it straight out of the book. It says, this phrase may allude to a lottery number or to the various biblical passages referring to the number of your days, i.e. the length of your life. For example, in Job 38:21, knowest thou it because thou wast then born, or because the number of thy days is great?
Ah, hey, that's a much older explanation than I would have thought.
Yeah, but it could be a biblical idiom.
A nod.
But it might also be from a lottery ticket.
I think it could be fun to go in, at least start with some of our basic numbers, like 1 through 10, though neither of us brought any number one idioms, so we're going to pretend like those don't exist for some reason.
what one idioms could, like number to be number one is kind of obvious.
I'm sure there are tons.
What's tricky is that because you'd say ah or an usually.
You can do a lot
something.
Of stuff like all rolled up into one for one thing, hole in one.
Yeah, you're right. There are plenty.
But all of them are pretty self-explanatory too.
And actually, I will say that all the ones I found about two were also pretty self-explanatory. You know, no two ways about it. Put two and two together. You've got that as a phrase, but you've also got and make five. So one of them is just taking the evidence and coming up with the right conclusion, and the other one is coming up with the wrong conclusion. Two can play that game. It's not about a specific game, particularly. And it takes two to tango. It is about a specific dance. Also, do you ever say, I don't give two hoots?
I don't say hoots, but yeah.
Ah, okay. Well, so,
I mean,
so
I could say I give a hoot about something or other, but generally speaking, I'm a little more profane than that.
Of course you are, Jess. Well, I'm not. I go all owly hooty. give two hoots, care two hoots. So a hoot, believe it or not, is an old measurement. A very, 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 very small one.
That
yeah,
sounds
I mean, you're
made
not
up.
Going to find it on a ruler or something. Yeah. So you know how an atom is so cool because it's unsplittable. It's the smallest particle. Well, another word for just the smallest possible imaginable amount was hoot. A hoot. So to give two hoots is to give two of a very, 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 very small amount.
That's very funny. I would never have guessed that.
I found a nice quote from 1923. It's not particularly old, by the way. I think it might be the late 19th century, but mostly the 20th century. A quotation that says, "I am glad of that, even if he did tell me that as a supercargo. I wasn't worth a hoot in Hades," which I like. All I can imagine is an owl flapping around in hell. But goodness knows what the owl did.
I always assumed that was a minced oath of some kind, or that hoot was sort of used in the same way as like hootin' and hollerin', which is laughing and making a row.
Yeah, I was very surprised to find that it has been consistently used to mean a very, 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 very small amount.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Have we done 2 cents before?
I don't know if we have, but we should go there anyway.
Like my 2 cents. I mean, the notion, it's pretty basic. The 16th century expression, a penny for your thoughts, has also been around. So perhaps giving 2 cents is double that. It's also suggested that it might have something to do with a story from the Bible in which a poor widow places 2 small coins into the offering, and that's all she has, as opposed to a tiny fraction of the rich merchant's fortunes that they're also giving little bits of. Another possibility is that because it's relatively recently found to say my 2 cents versus my 2 pennies worth and things like that, is that it had to do with, it came from a well-known gambler, despite the little money that he had. He was always willing to bet on a new hopeful boxer. And so he'd say, to my 2 cents in for Johnson.
That's interesting. So you think that the 2 pennies worth maybe came first? Because I would assume so as well, just because the form of that we actually use, we don't tend to say my 2 pennies worth. We use a really antiquated word for a penny's worth. We say penneth. Here's my 2 penneth.
That's very cute.
It's a very much contracted version of penny's worth or tuppence worth, my 2 penneth. I haven't heard anyone use that for quite a while, but I believe it's still current, even if the tuppence is not.
I've also seen an explanation, though I don't think it has as many legs as some of the other explanations, that the early cost of postage in England was the 2 penny post was a normal amount. Which would also, that would make sense as an explanation for sharing your thoughts, right?
Oh, I like that one.
It's cute.
That's not a bad one.
The fun thing about the idiom episodes, right? Is like sometimes the incorrect origins are as interesting as the explanations, if not more so.
Did you get anything for 3? Are we on 3 yet?
Yeah, I think we're on 3. We're on the third time's the charm. So we've arrived here.
Yeah, why is it?
It's kind of vague. The older version is just the third time is lucky. And this is just one of these broader tendencies to treat 3 as a complete sequence. Like it's culturally important because it is the smallest number that creates a repeating pattern or a complete structure in storytelling. 2 gives you a pair, but 3 gives you a beginning, a middle, and an end, or a past, present, and a future, or a setup and a conclusion, plus, you know, triangles and trinities across all religions.
Yeah, trinities, of course. Rule of 3.
Right, exactly. Rule of 3, which is the idea that groups of 3 feel especially satisfying or memorable or complete, like friends, Romans, and countrymen, or life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or stop, drop, and roll.
But 3 is also a crowd, so it can sometimes be 1 too many.
And bad luck comes in 3s.
Yeah, this is true.
For every proverb, we have an equal and opposite proverb.
We do. It's good. You can sound wise, whatever the outcome.
Isn't that kind of the point of Polonius's speech in Hamlet that has all of the famous idioms? It's like he's just offering empty advice, some of which contradicts itself.
Yes, he is throwing number 2 against the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yes. 3 Dog Night is the other one that I wanted to do. And this is probably, I don't know whether this is true or not. The notion is that it refers to temperatures so cold that a person, especially like an Inuit person, would need 3 sled dogs sleeping beside them for warmth. And then the widely repeated story about the band 3 Dog Night is it, it was repeated in a documentary and a few other contexts. Apparently, Australian Aboriginal people also used it to describe a cold night where you needed three dogs around you.
Oh.
Which, I mean, I have three dogs, so every night is a three-dog night for me.
That's adorable. Well, I would never have guessed that it was about just being cuddled by dogs.
Right.
And you say, oh, it relates to Inuit. I thought, oh, okay, it's where like the night is so sort of rough that you need three dogs to pull the sled. I'd have gone, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But no, it's not. Snuggling.
None of the explanations are particularly grounded in evidence, so take that with a grain of salt or a frost mite or something like that.
Take that with a snowflake.
All right.
Okay, in which case, full credit to John Ato, the author of the Oxford Dictionary of Idioms. Under four, the idioms given are the four corners of the world, sea corner. I actually know what that one is. It's just about maps, you know, maps having mm-hmm. four corners. It's not that complicated, really.
That's fun, though.
Yeah, it's a good one. On all fours, equal with, presenting an exact analogy with. Yeah, I say, so that's actually, I haven't heard the phrase used like that. So to be on all fours with something is to be equal to. It wasn't something I'd heard.
Yeah, no, I don't think that I've ever heard it in that way. I feel like any use of that term now would be like referring to being like demeaned or sexualized yeah, in exactly. some way.
Or just, you know, having to do something on the floor. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be sexualized, Jess. That's what John Ato gives us for four. Greatly, I'm sure we can come up with some more intriguing ones with four. If we think about it again, maybe we'll revisit this. On to five. Now, a lot of the five ones are related to these. Aren't they?
Oh, yes.
The fact that we have five digits per hand. I was going to say fingers, but I don't want the under the liners telling me the thumb's not a finger. Whatever. But, you know, you've got to give someone a bunch of fives to punch them. It's just, you know, hit them with your hand, which has five fingers. Give someone a high five. That's the same five we're talking about. Gimme five, you might also say. And then there's a five-finger discount. As well, which is
that's stealing,
stealing something. Yeah, your discount card is your five fingers. Yeah, exactly. Pilfered it.
Do you have any sixes? This is turning into a game of old maid.
Six is quite a rich one, actually. We've got lots to talk about with six. I would say, here's one that I don't know, again, if you have it in the States, but you ever talk about six of the best, giving someone six of the best?
I don't know that I do know that one, but I'm sure that I could just be forgetting.
It's not a good thing. It's to punish someone. I'll give them six. Oh, sorry. I just gave my microphone one of the best.
Six of the best.
Sorry. Sorry, microphone. You haven't done so anything wrong. We might talk about slapping, you know, punishing someone by giving them six of the best. And it does literally come from boys' schools in England, where a punishment was six of the best, which meant hitting them six times with a cane.
Ouch.
Six times. Whip, 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 huh. Whip, whip, whip. Not very nice, but it passed.
No, not very nice at all.
More general parlance from boys' schools, presumably from adult boys who graduated through that rather cruel corporal punishment that was experienced in those days.
Six also has some negative associations, right? Like it's the 666 is like the devil's number. I did not look this one up, so I don't know how old that concept is.
Yeah, the number of the beast, 666. I don't know either.
The Beast of Revelation is what it's from.
Oh.
In most manuscripts of the New Testament and English translations of the Bible, the number of the beast is 666. And I don't know why.
So that's like proper Bible canon that's the number of the beast. Interesting. You might encounter him if you find yourself 6 feet under. It's a clear reference to how deeply you're buried. But what I was interested in was whether or not graves actually do have to be 6 feet deep. And neither in the United States nor in Britain do they. There is no law about that. In Britain, they have to be a minimum of 3 feet deep, which doesn't seem terribly deep. But supposedly the 6 feet deep idea comes from the Great Plague. So the 1600s, it might be a bit earlier than that, but the idea is that if you bury people deep enough, then you can't catch diseases
get sick from them.
the bodies. Yeah, but there are also other benefits to it, like scavengers can't get at them so easily. It's easier for the grave digger because 6 foot is about, you know, about as high as it can be with them still being able to just about haul themselves out. But also it not being so high that they can't chuck the turf out over the top as they're digging as well. So quite a lot of logic to it. I thought that was worth looking up. Actually, yeah. I looked up the UK Parliament website to find out what the actual law is in Britain. And it says in 1666 and again in 1679, Parliament ordered that all bodies should be buried in a shroud of woolen cloth. So this isn't related to the 6 feet under thing, but I just think it's quite interesting that they did stipulate that. Do you know why they said they should be in a woolen cloth? Well, so there's the reason they gave, which is to protect against disease. But the reason they just thought it was probably implemented was to boost the wool industry by making every time someone dies, they at least get to provide them with a shroud. Which, I thought that was pretty
fascinating.
Cool. But the practice of digging graves to a depth of 6 feet goes back to at least the 16th century, it says here, and is believed to be a precaution against plague.
I took a ghost tour one time in New Orleans where we passed by a particular area and, you know, it's very swampy there. Apparently, there are a good amount of mausoleums, like above ground graves and things in New Orleans, because for a time they would bury people and then the rains would come and then the corpses would just like slide down the hill into your yard.
If you want some more burial law, regulations now specify that there must be a layer of earth at least 6 inches between each coffin in a grave. There you go. That's a nice little fact. This is grim. Let's move on.
Yeah, no, I'm having fun, so.
Tell us about surely the most modern idiom term that we're going to come to, which is 6-7.
6-7. Well, we should probably start with sixes and sevens, right? There are a variety of phrases here, like at sixes.
But we should
and sevens.
Be clear not to link those two things, right? Just because they both have 6 and 7 in them.
6-7 is not related to at sixes and sevens, though. Seeing this may leave you at sixes and sevens because it means confused or disorganized or in disagreement. And it appears to have developed from an older phrase to set on 6 and 7, meaning to risk everything or leave matters to chance. And the OED's word on this is that it has something to do with dice and maybe a fanciful alteration of an earlier phrase about setting on some of the highest numbers in dice.
There's a very early Chaucer quotation that uses that precise phrase that you talked about, set on 6 and 7s. In Troilus and Cressida, he writes, "Let not this wretched woe thine heart gnaw, but manly set the world on 6 and 7. And if thou die a martyr, go to heaven." It's saying, don't let this woe gnaw at your heart. Be a man and risk everything. And if you do so, if you die, you'll at least go to heaven.
The confusion sense, I wasn't quite clear on, but perhaps it's just the notion that like losing everything leaves you in disorder.
Yeah, it's an interesting one that I wonder if that's not just the result of a misinterpretation of it that's caught on. Because it doesn't seem right, does it?
Yeah, so, no, it doesn't. It's not a very satisfying explanation.
Maybe influenced by 6 of 1 and half a dozen of the other, this sort of ambivalence idea. I don't know.
I mean, it dates back to like the 1500s at the very least.
Meaning confusion.
Meaning like careless, negligent, or left in confusion. There's a, in 1785, there's a, the Francis Groves, our friend of the Classical Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue, says left at 6s and 7s means in confusion, commonly said of a room where the furniture is scattered about or business left unsettled. Perhaps it's evoking the tossing of the die or something like that.
Oh, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sort of at a moment of sort of confused suspense, not knowing how the die are going to fall, maybe.
Yeah. I speculation.
Stretching.
Here.
Stretching. Yeah. Stretching.
The OED doesn't have a very satisfying why on that one.
Do we need to go into the 6-7 thing then?
Well, somebody asked about it. Yeah, and I did. I've written for I wrote the entry and an explanation for a popular dictionary brand in the States.
A sort of dictionary, a .com brand.
I cannot. I am. My contract will not allow me to confirm or deny which dictionary brand I am referring to, whether it is a com or otherwise. but anyway, it is thought to have originated with a song Doot Doot 6-7 by Skrilla, which repeats 6-7 as a hook. And I am not cool enough to know anything about Skrilla beyond that. It also apparently was popularized in videos about NBA players who, like LaMelo Ball, who is 6'7" tall. And there were a bunch of viral clips on TikTok and Instagram that paired the song with basketball visuals dating back to like 2024. So it's been around for a minute. And then it became a meme template. And then this one kid who's known as the 6'7" kid helped popularize the slang more broadly when a video of him shouting 6'7" with the hand gesture at a youth basketball game went viral. Then the basketball players themselves started doing it, and it was a whole thing.
I think we're already past it, aren't we? I think in 10 years' time, no one's going to be talking about it. Well,
yeah,
actually,
no,
I think in 3 years' time, no one's going to be talking about it, except maybe people like us going on, oh, yeah, yeah, let's explain 6-7.
Right.
The
reason we're already past it is because kids were using it to be confusing and random in their classrooms.
We ruined
it. And now
it's
not cool because the old people like us started explaining it. My favorite variation of it, though, is 6-sendy, which is related to the phrase getting sendy, like send it. Yeah. Anyway, back to...
Let's get to our usual territory. I can understand, eh? Have we talked about Seventh Heaven before?
No, I don't think we have.
This is another theological reference. It's not just Christianity. It's sort of Abrahamic idea that there are seven layers to heaven. The top one is where God's hanging out with the angels. Really important one. I was very surprised to find that this term was in use in Old English. Sjöfvan Hjöfvan. Look at that. Seventh heaven. I just did not think that was going to be it.
There is a lot of like religious and even like old scientific significance to seven. Like one of the reasons seven became kind of a big thing in general is the Ptolemaic system in ancient Greek astronomy, which has the seven classical planets by order of their apparent proximity to Earth in the then current geocentric model. And by planets, I mean the Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And the day was divided into like 7-hour intervals. And ultimately, this also gave us the 7-day week and the names for it too. So we have, you know, Sunday, Saturn Day, Moon Day, and then, of course, English went all Germanic with it, but like French still has Mars Day and Mercury Day and Jupiter Day and Venus Day. All throughout all religion and mythology, we've got like the 7 days of creation, the seven deadly sins, the seven sacraments, the seven chakras, the sages, the wonders, etc. Seven is consistently considered one of people's favorite numbers. When people are asked to choose a number from 1 through 10, they pick 7 more often than they pick any other number.
Yeah, I wonder why that is.
Probably because it is also affiliated with luck, partially because when rolling 2 standard 6-sided dice, 7 is the most likely total because 6 different combinations can produce it. That's also why we get lucky 7.
Right.
One that stumped me, this one is, it can be said with 6, 7, 9, or 2, 4, or from, but like 6 ways from Sunday or 7 ways to Sunday means thoroughly or completely or in every possible direction, or it can mean in a disordered, frantic, or uncontrollable state of mind. I could not find a good explanation.
I was already disorientated. I have no idea what you're on about right now.
The phrase
is 2 from 6, 7, 8, 1 from 2. What were you on about? I'm so confused.
There are lots of different forms of this idiom. One of them is 6 ways from Sunday. Another one is 7 ways from Sunday. Another one is 9 ways from Sunday. And this dates back to like early 1700s. Like it's...
What does it mean?
It means disordered or in every possible direction or in an uncontrolled way. So if you are like, we investigated this idiom 6 ways from Sunday to ensure we didn't miss a single thing, but we found nothing anyway. My idea, like the visual that comes to mind is that, you know, there are 7 days of the week. So if you're looking in every direction, you're looking at every other day of the week. But I couldn't find a good confirmation of any of that. It's just like most of what I found was just the use in context. And that's not as helpful.
It brings to mind slightly one that we didn't go into when we were talking about three, which is three sheets to the wind. I didn't go into it in my research because we already covered it when we talked about nautical idioms, because
it's sails.
yeah. It is sails.
Isn't it that you untie three sails so that you can go faster?
Yeah, but why would that mean you were drunk?
Oh, no, it's untied so you cannot control the ship.
You're flapping around. That's it. It's all your sails are flapping around like you're drunk. The reason I also raised that is that it leads me onto an eight idiom that I didn't know about, but I only came across while doing this research and looking up eight idioms. Idioms related to eight. And there is one that means to be drunk, which is one over the eight. I'm going to start using it.
Could that have something to do with pool?
No, it doesn't. Although there is something about eight balls that you guys use when we say snookered and you say something like one behind the eight or something, don't you? What's that American
behind
term?
The eight ball.
Behind the eight ball. There we go.
But that means like something else.
Yeah. One over the eight means you're drunk.
Behind the eight ball means you're losing.
It means you're snookered, I think, is how we put it. Because it's from the fact that if you are behind the eight ball, you don't have a shot open to you that's not a foul. Different balls, different tables, but ultimately the same sentiment. One over the eight is drunk, and it's from a received wisdom that you could drink eight beers and be fine, but if you have one more, you'll be intoxicated.
Sure, let's go with that.
Tested that, went to a Cure gig the other day, and came pretty close to testing that particular theory. I would say I fell at least one short of the eight and was not in a good state the following day.
The 7 year itch is the restless desire for change after, especially if you've been married for 7 years, which I've been married for 11 years, almost 11 years. And so far I'm not that itchy. So I don't know what the deal is, but it became popular through the play.
But that in turn is transferred from the idea of the 7 year itch being scabies or some other complaint, right? That comes back, that recurs for 7 years. Every year for 7 years. And then it gets used to describe figuratively, getting the itch to philander.
After 7 years. The other seven one that I have is the seven league boots, which are magical boots that allow the wearer to travel seven leagues in a single stride. And they appear in a lot of European fairy tales, but most famously Charles Perrault's Hop of My Thumb or Little Thumbling. And the character Hop of My Thumb or Le Petit Boucher is the youngest of seven children of a poor woodcutter. And he's unusually wise and bright despite being tiny. And when he and his siblings are abandoned by their parents, he keeps everyone safe from various dangers, including being chased by an ogre. And then he steals the ogre's magic seven league boots.
Right. And he's one of seven children.
Yes. He is the youngest of seven children.
So the fairy tales are also into the sevens, clearly, with the seven dwarves as well. Any more with the sevens and the eights?
I do not have any sevens or eights. I forgot that eight existed.
All right, so we've got one over the eight, an idiom that none of us have ever heard of. that's what you gain.
Neither one nor eight to this equation.
Nine's a big one. Nine is a really big one that we covered in our second ever idioms episode. It's worth just, I suppose, running through some of the nine ones.
Yeah, we had like three or four of those, I think.
Like dressed up to the nines, phrase supposedly from the 99th Wiltshire Regiment, noted for their particularly smart appearance.
We did cloud nine.
So there were classifications of cloud altitude. I think the highest is actually 10. So cloud nine is still really high. But the phrase has been on cloud seven in the past as well. It's because, I don't know.
Basically nearest to heaven or something like that.
Yeah, good shout. The whole nine yards as well. That's one of those ones where there's lots of fun theories about where it came from. No one's totally sure. There's this 19th century anecdote, the judge's big shirt, in which a judge arrives in Raleigh. Raleigh, North Carolina, for a business trip without the right shirt for a formal party he's attending. He asks a lawyer friend to sort one for him to teach the judge a lesson. He sources a gigantic shirt, 5 yards long and 4 yards broad. the lawyer friend pretends to have no idea what's happened and says to the seamstress, "What a silly, stupid woman. I told her to get just enough to make 3 shirts. Instead of making 3, she has put the whole 9 yards into 1 shirt.
the fun part of that idiom, I think, is that there are a dozen explanations for it that range from like military to sports, et cetera. And whoever is citing that is certain that they are right about it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Fighter jets had 27 feet of ammunition. If you fired them all off, you went the full 9 yards. It's the length of a kilt, apparently, full 9 yards. Another is that it refers to the amount that a concrete truck could dispense. I don't really get that one, but fine. Lots of theories for that one.
In defense of the fighter jet one, although that's not the first recorded instance of that phrase by a long shot, it was popularized in the context of like aviation with that explanation. So like it's not the first recorded instance of it, and it's not the original explanation for it, but it is an explanation for it and one of the reasons it got bigger.
That's legit, isn't it? If a reason is that something becomes popular is a specific context, then that makes it worth a mention for sure. Yeah. Those are the ones that we already did before, but there are more idioms involving nines or received wisdoms involving nines, aren't there?
Yes. A stitch in time saves 9 is another Taylor-y one. That's the notion that a small repair made early prevents a much larger repair later. And I don't know that it's that whether the 9 is 9 stitches or whether it's just because it rhymes with time.
I always assumed that it was you do 1 stitch now for the sake of saving having to do 9 stitches later. You've got a hole that's a 1 stitcher.
Right.
Could be a 9 stitch repair if you leave it too long. That's what's always been in my head.
But the specificity, and then cats. Yeah. Oh yeah, cats. Cats have 9 lives.
They do.
Supposedly.
Well, yeah, to us they do, but yeah, in some cultures they've got different numbers of lives.
Like 7 lives think sometimes.
They've got, yeah. Spanish think they've got 7. I was reading about this. There was a popular TV show on Spanish TV called Siete Vidas, 7 Lives. It took place in Madrid, and the people of Madrid are nicknamed El Gatos, the cats. So that's why the show is called
Excellent
7 Lives. Yeah.
The earliest English recorded instance the OED has is a 1546 collection of proverbs collected by John Haywood, but it predates that in English anyway, because the line in that proverb is that a woman has 9 lives like a cat. So that notion already existed at that point.
Yeah, I mean, this is the folly of looking for these things in written texts, is that these things obviously catch on verbally before they catch on in print.
It has been suggested that in ancient Egypt, the goddess Bastet had something to do with a cat's many lives, but there's not a lot of evidence that stories around that goddess really inspired a specific number.
Yeah, but 7 was an important number to the Egyptians. I don't recall a specific reason why I'm saying that, but I just got it in my head that it is.
Since you're in possession of that thought, I did try to find out why possession is 9/10 of the law is an idiom.
Oh,
it basically, nice. It's a fancier way of saying finders keepers.
Yeah.
But it dates back to at least the 1800s, and it means that the person who physically controls something has a strong practical advantage in a dispute over ownership, or that they've stolen something. And right. That's a whole thing. But the notion is a lot older than the 1800s. And there's a record from an antiquary in the 17th century of a proverb saying possession is 11 points of the law out of a supposed 12. I also couldn't find an explanation beyond that, where 12 points in a law came from. I saw explanations saying that like Scottish law involved 12 points, but I got stuck.
It surely involves the number of points that are necessary to make the law work, right? I'd have thought. not duodecimal or decimal systems, I wouldn't have thought.
10?
Have you got a 10?
I have 10.
Go on.
All right. So because base 10 is so common, 10 shows up in a lot of idioms, like 10 out of 10, that doesn't need an explanation. But feeling 10 feet tall, like feeling extremely successful or confident, is more recent than I would have thought. The OED has it only dating back to the 1950s, but 10 foot has been used as a modifier for a really long thing or big stuff much longer than that, like a like 10-foot coal, for example, was used to describe particularly large coal deposits in Yorkshire. And it wasn't specifically a 10-foot seam, but just a really thick one. A 10-foot pole, by the way, which you wouldn't touch someone with, was originally a 40-foot pole. So it seems we became marginally more tolerant over time, though there was also the variation, wouldn't touch someone with a barge pole, which is 8 to 16 feet.
Is that idiom one that you come across often? Because we still use wouldn't touch him with a barge pole quite a lot in Britain.
I do not use that one frequently.
It's the pole that you use to push a barge underneath a bridge when the horse can't pull it along. So yeah, it's a very long pole that needs to be able to reach the walls of the tunnel or the bridge as you sort of push yourself along, I think.
The earliest references to not touching people with very long poles dates back to like the mid-1800s, but it's also been around for a while earlier. The earliest one was 40 feet, and then the barge pole, and then the 10-foot pole, and then, of course, the 39.5-foot pole with which you would not touch the Grinch.
Very good.
I will say, a similar idiom is not to be handled with a pair of tongs, which has variations dating back to 1643, and the OED suggested that it might be related to Chaucer's The Parson's Tale, in which we have an image of the devil's furnace with the personifications of pride and envy and contentiousness causing people to sin. And in particular, the personification of envy holds a hot iron to the heart of a person with a pair of very long tongs made of hatred and ill will. Have you ever heard of a big cowboy hat being called a 10-gallon hat?
I have. Yes.
This is a fun one. Do you know why?
I just assumed it was a sort of exaggeration on how big it was and how much it could hold.
There are two explanations. One of them is that the term 10-gallon is a corruption of the Spanish modifier 10-galán, which means really handsome. Oh. So un sombrero 10-galán is a very fine hat, which is adorable.
That's nice.
But it could also be a corruption of a similar Spanish word for the trim around the crown of a hat, according to the Cowboy Hat Book, which was published in 1995.
Favorite book.
Excellent book. Even if it referred to an actual 10 gallons, the 10 gallon was not the holding capacity of the hat, which is in fact 3/4 of a US gallon. But in fact, it was the width of a Mexican sombrero hat band, which is more closely related to the unit of measurement by the Spanish than to the water holding capacity of a Stetson, which the Stetson being another word for the classic cowboy hat, because the modern style is attributed to 19th century hat maker John Batterson Stetson. However, print ads from Stetson did show a cowboy giving his horse a drink of water from a hat. So, oh,
yeah, that
would have helped. Yes.
I suggest that we depart from the numerical order thing here and just go for sweep up some more numerical idioms.
The only other one I had that was in order was turn it up to 11, which is from Spinal Tap.
Oh, yeah, Spinal Tap. This one goes up to 11.
But Chico Marx more or less makes the same joke in Duck Soup. Groucho's character, Rufus T. Firefly, says, give me a number from 1 to 10, and Chico says 11.
That's not the same joke, though, is it?
I mean, it's kind of the same idea.
No, it's not. His point is that he's got... I don't want to have to explain it to you like Marty DeBurgi had to explain it to him.
Right, yeah, yeah.
The point is that his dial goes up to 11 so that he can go one higher than 10 if he needs to. But why not just make 10 louder? He says, yeah, but this goes up to 11. And that's me putting on my impression of an American doing a British accent. Even though he actually does a really good British accent.
It was a great movie.
Fantastic movie. We should talk about dozens. I dare say we've talked about a baker's dozen before, but it's a story worth reiterating. The idea being that bakers would cook an extra loaf to ensure that if someone bought a dozen, an actual dozen, they would be able to give them 12 that met the weight requirements of the law, because the punishments were weirdly severe for serving someone a bit of bread that didn't have enough wheat in it.
That makes sense.
They've also been called a devil's dozen in the past, which also meant 13, a long dozen as well, and a printer's dozen, which does seem like something I should have looked up. But
oh, yeah. It's got to be the same thing, right? So you have an extra one in case somebody buys a dozen.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you print an extra one off or in case one of them's got like a dodgy page in it or something like that. I don't know. Can I bring up one that I found really fun? The $64,000 question. Do you know how much it originally was? It wasn't $64,000. Originally, the idiom was a smaller amount.
What was it?
$64.
Oh.
Super cheap question, really.
Is 64,000 has to be from the name of the show, though, right?
The original term, $64 question, is from a CBS radio show from the 1940s called Take It or Leave It, which was a quiz show. And the biggest prize they had was $64. So you'd be asked a question that was worth $64. And then there's been an extraordinary amount of inflation that's taken it to 64,000, to the $1 million question. People say the $1 billion question now, and probably right. The $1 trillion question. But originally it was just a $64 question.
Presumably the quiz show, the $64,000 question, was an exaggeration of that earlier one, right?
Right. I actually didn't know about that quiz show. So
that's the one that made anti-disestablishmentarianism famous.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. That's
Which
one
I've
of your favorite
you.
Origin yeah. stories. Yeah,
it is.
It's a good
it
one.
Is.
Mm. Yeah, you recently did a really good blog post about that, actually, on your Substack. I'll plug that for you.
It's also on my regular blog. I am being a bit lazy with my various publishing outlets.
Are you just copying and pasting from your blog?
Sometimes. The $64,000 question did go through. It ended up being relatively infamous because it was found to have a great deal of scandal around it, like with people being fed answers and things like that. And it made some news that Patty Duke ended up being on the $64,000 question. She had to testify in like a Senate inquiry about it, which was interesting. It was widely televised and very spicy, and it was part of a larger set of scandals about 1950s quiz shows that ended up being challenged because they were misleading the public.
Funny, in Britain we had a scandal along those lines, but only in the sort of 2000s and 2010s, when it became apparent that a lot of game shows were actually rigging their quizzes. Now, the rules on having a quiz on like a radio show or a television show in Britain are unbelievably strict, just because of this period where it turned out that occasionally people might have been giving the prizes to family members, or you know, if no one was calling in with the right answer, they would make someone up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway,
all for the
not
spectacle.
Naming names, so it's fine. Yeah, exactly.
Since we're on the topic of TV idioms, I could mention 1-4-3. Are you familiar with this one?
1-4-3. It's in the numbers 1-4-3. Wow, that's great. We're getting.
Do you know what it
three
means?
For the price of one. No idea.
It means I love you on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Oh, it's the number of letters for each word. Very
Mr.
Sweet.
Rogers' Neighborhood, Fred Rogers uses the numbers 1 and 4. And 3 to mean I love you from the number of letters in each word. Reportedly, Mr. Rogers also maintained his weight at 143 pounds for the last 30 years of his life. I don't know whether that's true.
What other sentences could it be? bag.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So I've never actually seen this in real life, but social media dictionaries also tell me that the number 1437 is also used in the same way as a numeric expression of the phrase I love you forever, with forever being 7 letters. And then there's 831, which is a song by Lisa Stanfield recorded in 2001. And the chorus goes 8 letters, 3 words, 1 meaning, which translates to I love you.
Yeah, I love it when my idioms involve maths. Math. Can I give us one more before we put this episode to bed?
Please.
That's 40 winks.
That's a fun one. I don't know why we say 40.
Yeah, it's to have a little nap. To be honest, I'm not going to be able to tell you why we say 40, other than that historically 40 is just used to be a big number.
Yeah.
You know, it's throughout the Bible. Oh, Jesus goes off into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. Can you think of a bigger number than 40? No. And 40 winks is basically that.
Like a 40-foot pole.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a big number. But I found the earliest written citation of it. A 40 winks nap in a horizontal posture is the best preparative for any extraordinary exertion of either. And that is from a book called The Art of Invigorating and Prolonging Life by Food, Clothes, Air, Exercise, Wine, Sleep, etc., and Peptic Precepts, pointing out agreeable and effectual methods to prevent and relieve indigestion and to regulate and strengthen the action of the stomach and bowels, by William Kitchener.
That's a mouthful, William.
I'm glad we do things better. There might even be 40 words there. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, 40 winks. But it is winks being used to mean sleep goes back much further than the phrase 40 winks. But a nap is having 40 winks.
With that, we 143 you, and we'll see you next time on Words Unraveled.